People throughout time, it seems, have been fascinated by the possibility of psychic phenomena. That is the idea, for example, that individuals could communicate with one another without words, that you might know what another person was thinking, or that they would know what you were thinking, or that physical objects could be affected by a person's mind. Surveys, of course, tell us today that indeed most of the world's people do believe in psychic phenomena. However, it seems that most scientists do not. We'll be talking this morning with a scientist who has indeed done research in this area and works at one of just two full-time academic research labs that do work on psychic phenomena. His name is Dean Radin. He's director of the Consciousness Research Laboratory at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. He's also done cutting-edge parapsychological research for some big corporations, including AT&T and Contel. He's also worked for Princeton's Department of Psychology, for the University of Edinburgh, SRI International, and the U.S. government. And he's the author of a book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of his book is The Conscious Universe, The Scientific Truth of Psychic Phenomena. He says that indeed people who are interested in this are moving beyond issues of belief and anecdote. And he argues and presents in his book evidence that there indeed are reliable scientific studies that have shown that the kinds of things that we're talking about are real. Psychic phenomena are real. He says that they have been shown to exist in thousands of experiments, and he talks about some of them in his book. As we talk, you should certainly feel free to call in if you have questions, comments, so you want to be a part of our conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. And if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, Dr. Radin, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate
it.
How did you become interested in this yourself?
Well, actually, part of my interest started right there in Champaign when I went to graduate school at the University of Illinois. And I guess one of my interests as a teenager was an incompatibility between the science fiction and the folklore that I had read, in which psychic phenomena seemed to be taken for granted. And then both the engineering and the psychology curriculums that I was in which not only was it not taken for granted, but was considered so taboo that it was never even mentioned. And I just thought it was odd that that the world would be split so easily into two different kinds of beliefs, which is not to say that folklore and stories and so on, it could just be flights of imagination. And, of course, later on, as I had learned in psychology, that of course, we all have wishful thinking and delusion and memory selection and lots of other psychological reasons why we may wish those stories to be true. Still, I felt that there was something that happens even in technical environments, which has adopted the name Murphy's Law, which means anything that can go wrong will go wrong. And that folklore within the technical environment kind of suggests that there's something about human anxiety, human intention or need or motivation that affects the world around us. And that, to me, sounded a lot like some of the psychic phenomena. So even though I was taking fairly conventional courses in electrical engineering and later in psychology, I never dropped the idea that maybe there was something not only interesting but testable.
It seems that what perhaps may make the whole area confusing or difficult to talk about is that so many things may be lumped under the heading of psychic phenomena, and particularly if you start using a term like paranormal, for example, a very wide range of things might fall under that heading. When you use the term psychic phenomena, what really are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about in neutral terms, unexplained exchanges of information between people and between people and objects, or people and the environment. And what that includes then are what we have labeled telepathy, where there's an exchange of information between two people's minds, and clairvoyance, where there's an exchange between a person and the environment in some way, and even psychokinetic ability or mind-matter interaction, in which there seems to be an exchange, the flow of exchange is between the person and the environment. In other words, it appears as though something is being injected back into the environment, not as force, but as an informational tweak.
Well, I want to talk about some of the experiments that have been done looking at psychic phenomena, and we'll start with maybe one of the simplest ones and the thing that perhaps people have heard of or are familiar with, the kind of experiments that have been done with different sorts of designs to test the possibility either of ESP or of clairvoyance. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of the card deck experiments where, for example, you have two people and you give one of them a deck of cards that has a number of cards that have basic symbols on them of different kinds, like maybe a triangle, a circle, a square, a star, something like that, in this deck in a random order. And you give the cards to one person, and you put another person across the table from them, and you say to the person with the cards, "See if you can project this image, however you think you can do it, without saying anything or showing it anyway. You know, see if you can give this person the image that's on the card." And then the other person, you know, you flip through the deck and the other person says circle, square, star, whatever.
Right.
And, of course, if say we have five, you go through a deck like this, we have five different symbols, the chances of that person guessing are 1 in 5. So you figure there's a 20% chance that they're just going to get, that they're going to guess, and just by luck, they're going to choose the right one.
Right.
And different experiments have been done with different sorts of designs. But when you do something like that, what do you find, and how much better than chance do you find that people can do in these kinds of experiments?
Well, these studies began in the late 1800s and were pretty popular up until about the 1950s. Very few researchers are using this technique now for some reasons I'll describe in a minute. But basically, all told, from the 1880s to about the 1940s, there were about 4 million cards used in experiments, as you just described, by several dozen investigators around the world. And on the basis of any individual test, you can't really say much. Sometimes you'd get a statistically significant result, and sometimes you would not. But as I tried to point out in my book, the name of the game in science and trying to provide evidence for a phenomena is whether independent experiments are repeated. So if you look at the historical record and you simply ask the question, have experiments been seeing about the same effect over a long period of time? In the case of ESP card tests, the answer is yes. With a 20% hit rate, you're getting a few percentage over that. It's not a large effect by any means. But when you look at the confidence interval around the few percent effect, they're extremely tight. In other words, the margin of error around the few percent is very, very small. Mm-hmm. And so we can make a statistical assessment that even though we're only seeing a couple of percent over chance, the odds against chance of seeing that effect at all is somewhere in the realm of a billion to one or beyond that.
Mm. I'm for someone like me, for a layperson, the statistics are a little bit beyond me, but I guess coming to it from that perspective, my sort of reaction is, yes, that if you get results there that are a few points better than chance, it's true that that's better than chance. However, it's not wildly better than chance, and I guess I would say, again, sort of as the layperson, I'd say, well, you know, if you could show me you could do that, and instead of the hit rate being 20 you know, 23%, if you could show me somebody who could consistently do it, or a group of people who could do it at 50% or 75%, now then I'd say, okay, maybe you got something.
Right.
And I guess there the question really is, how much better than chance does it have to be to suggest that indeed it is not, it's not simply chance?
Right. There's two issues here which are often confused in the statistics. First of all, there's the issue of, is the effect that we're looking at merely chance? And of course, if a chance level here is 20%, and let's say we had a 23% hit rate, then you can say, well, but you know, 3% doesn't sound like much. Mm-hmm. But the real question is that 3% a real 3%? Does it include 20%, or is it really 23? It's exactly 23. And the answer is that we have extremely high confidence that we're dealing with something like 23 and not 20. And that means, yes, it's a small statistical effect, but we have very high confidence that that is a real effect, and it's not just chance. The other way of looking at the same issue, because I hear this a lot, the idea of, well, it sounds so weak and statistical, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
The story I like to say, I like to tell is, imagine that there were people out there in the world who we paid millions of dollars a year to do something, and they were considered the best in the world, and yet they could only do it one in three times. That would seem like a rather odd thing to do, to give people millions of dollars a year to do something only one in three times, and yet we call them baseball players, and it's because the base hit rate, even among the best in the world, is somewhere around batting 300, or 30%. That means that two-thirds of the time when a batter goes up to plate, they won't even get a base hit. Well, the reason why this extremely high variability is accepted by the owners who are paying them that much money is because we recognize that human performance is very variable, even among the best in the world. So when we're looking at something like psychic phenomena, where we really don't have a very good sense yet how to, or what we're dealing with and how to measure it precisely, we're always going to be working with a highly variable result, and especially so in a laboratory where we're dealing with something which is basically an artificial version of what people report in real life. One of the reasons why the ESP cards lost favor after some years is because people get bored with the task very quickly. I mean, if you can imagine just sitting there and saying circle, square, wavy line 1,000 times in a row, mm-hmm. it just loses any motivation, and any effects that we see generally begin to drop off just out of sheer boredom. And new techniques were developed to keep people's motivation up, and we get much larger effects in those studies. But nevertheless, we're dealing with ordinary people who don't make any exceptional claims coming into the laboratory over a period of about 60 years and involving something like 20,000 people, and doing this ESP card test and getting an advantage over chance, which was consistent over those 60 years.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We're speaking this morning with Dr. Dean Radin. He's director of the Consciousness Research Laboratory at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas, and has done a lot of research in the era of parapsychology, both in the academic sphere and also for some large corporations. He's written a book that presents some of the evidence for the scientific truth of psychic phenomena. That's the subtitle of his book. The title is The Conscious Universe. It is published by Harper San Francisco. Certainly should be available in bookstore if you want to take a look at it. And, of course, your questions here are welcome. 333-WILL, a toll-free 800-222-WILL. We have a caller. Other people are welcome into the conversation with questions. This first person is in Champaign, and that would be line one. Hello.
Morning. I was wondering if your guest might have any familiarity with Carl Jung's research into paranormal psychology. Like I was thinking of his principle of synchronicity,
mm-hmm.
and such.
Sure.
How about when you talk about meaningful coincidence, do you deal with that aspect of things?
Well, there are some Jungians who think that synchronicity is not the same as a parapsychological effect. even though I would argue...
How could one know, metaphysically?
Right. See, the idea of an a-causal connection, a connection between events that is meaningful in some way, to me, actually sounds like what we do in the laboratory and what people report in the real world in terms of psychic phenomena. But the counter-argument is that if something is truly a-causal, meaning that there is no cause, no known cause between the two events, then that's what we call a synchronicity. I think it's actually a semantic fine point, and I would claim that when we arrange an experiment in the lab and we actually do see a connection, as yet unknown connection, between a person's mind and another person's mind, that looks an awful lot like a synchronicity to me.
You know, I'm thinking of his, I think he writes in one of his literature that a fellow died. All right, he's got a bunch of them where a scarab shows up when he's doing research on Egyptology.
Right.
And so it's a physical world interacting with, if one, say, the psychic world.
Right.
And I also, that's a pretty tricky thing to do any research on, I suppose, but have people examined instances of that sort of thing? And
oh, yeah. Over the years, there have been tens of thousands of case studies, like the one that you've mentioned that Jung reported. And there are consistencies among those tens of thousands of cases actually collected in almost every country in the world, and which, amongst other things, just gives us better confidence that these kinds of events occur not only to everyone, just about, but have kept occurring over history. And their frequency is not diminishing even in the modern world. So whatever we're dealing with appears to be a real phenomenon.
Is there a quotation marks? Does the scientific establishment come up with any explanation, or are they just say it's random chance or something?
Well, that's an interesting question, because 30 years ago, the prevailing view within science was that this was flatly impossible, because we didn't have any theories that were even close to this idea of what amounts to non-local connections. Of course, as the last 30 years have gone by, and we've gotten experimental verifications of ideas like non-local connections within quantum mechanics, well, suddenly it doesn't seem impossible anymore. We don't really see the connection of how you get non-locality at the psychological level, but nevertheless we know that it exists at the physical level. So
in quantum mechanics are analogies to synchronicity, aren't they?
Well, it appears that way, although I wouldn't want to push the model too far. But basically, if you look at the history of mainstream view of this topic, you find that in probably the last 5 years, there's been a very significant shift of opinion away from the direction that it's impossible and towards a direction that something is going on, but we don't know what it is. And this is true even among the more prominent skeptics, including people like Carl Sagan.
You know, it strikes me that quotation from Shakespeare about there are more things in heaven and earth ratio applies about as well now as it did then.
Well, and it's true actually in every realm of science. There are always unexpected or new discoveries at the leading edge, and initially they're resisted with ferocity, and eventually if it turns out that the data keeps supporting the idea, that theory will expand a little bit and accommodate the new facts. And I think that we're now moving towards a time where we don't really have the theories yet, but because science is coming around to the idea that at least we're dealing with something interesting, that theorists will begin to pay attention and we will develop new theories to account for these things.
Oh, interesting program. Thank you.
All right, thanks. You mentioned that the people who took part in these various kinds of the card experiments over the years were people that were not people that were making any special claims of having psychic powers. They were people, probably a lot of them were done on colleges, and they were just, you know, undergraduates, and they're people who were just recruited to do this off the street.
That's right.
Have there been any what you would consider really good, rigorous studies done of people who did in fact make claims that they had this ability? Because certainly there are people who do claim to.
Right. There have been several different categories of studies. There are the unselected volunteers, which really means self-selected. I mean, you can't go out and just grab somebody and force them to do an experiment, so people self-select. self-selection typically is on the basis of interest. And the interest usually comes about because of some experience that somebody has had, or maybe a family member has had. So we're not dealing automatically with a completely stratified, across-the-board sample of all people. We're dealing with interest, but still interest without exceptional claims. The next level up, say, in telepathy, is looking at family members, or what we call bonded pairs, couples, that have reported interesting moments of resonance, say. Then the next level up might be identical twins. The next level might be people who frequently report information passing between them somehow, and they don't understand how. And so if you look at these different levels, you could predict that you would actually get better performance in the laboratory, and the fact is that you do. You get better telepathy performance under well-controlled conditions where we know that there's no sensory leakage between the people. That is in accordance with what they report in their life. So that is seen in telepathy tests. There's another correlation that was predicted, which was that people who are more creative would have better scores in telepathy tests. And the way to test it was to select out subpopulations of musicians, authors, fine artists, and dancers as compared to, quote, ordinary people. And sure enough, the creative population did significantly better than the ordinary people. And among the creative populations, the musicians did significantly better.
We welcome questions, comments from people who are listening. We're full up, but let me give the numbers again just in case we want to get some other people to get in line here. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We'll go next to caller, I think, line one. Somebody on a cell phone here. Hello.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm a science teacher, and I've read some Herbert Sheldrake material on this subject and found it very fascinating. My question has to do with the level of abuse in the field of psychic. How do we deal with it without supporting the ripoff artist, so to speak? I'll hang up and just listen.
Okay.
Sure. The question is whether there's fraud and possibly delusion in psychic research, and the answer is, of course, yes, because scientists are human too. And of course, on the other side, people who do make exceptional claims about this topic many times have more than the scientific interest at heart. For example, I've worked with a number of people who come to the lab and want to be tested. And the reason they want to be tested is because they do something, they're a psychic or something, and they want to have a stamp of approval from a university. And this is why, basically, I don't do that anymore, because I'm not in the business of validating or verifying that somebody can do what they claim, especially if there's any economic reason underlying their interest. When it comes to the amount of fraud in this realm, I seriously doubt whether it's any different than any other scientific discipline. One of the reasons that fraud had come about was through the testing of people who basically wanted to show that you could trick a scientist into believing that some of these effects were real, where in fact they were tricks or conjuring tricks. And again, that's one of the reasons in the last 20 years that most parapsychologists these days do not work with people who make exceptional claims, because it's simply too risky. So I suppose one of the reasons why some scientists are reluctant to admit that the evidence is actually pretty solid, that we're dealing with real phenomena, they're reluctant to admit it because of this fear that the floodgates are going to suddenly open and all kinds of bizarre claims will be made. And I have great sympathy for this feeling, because I kind of find myself caught in the middle. On one side, we have extreme enthusiasts who are ready to believe everything and see everything as psychic, and there are omens everywhere, and it's hard to escape psychic this and that. And on the other side, you have extreme skeptics who are ready to debunk everything and can't see anything as psychic. And I'm really trying to, not only me, but my colleagues and I are scientists, or most of us trained as conventional scientists, and it's just very difficult to ignore this historical fact that people report these things all the time and still do. And what's more interesting is when we go into the lab and use standard techniques to study these things, we find evidence which support their experience. So we're not finding 100% accurate psychic phone lines, and we're not finding the X-Files, but we do find things that are worthy of serious study. And our belief is supported even by extreme skeptics who have actually paid attention to the evidence and come basically to the same conclusion. They're not willing typically to say this is psychic phenomena because in truth we don't really know what that is, but the skeptics and the scientific oversight committees that have been commissioned by the U.S. government to look at this issue have all basically come to the same idea that we're dealing with something which is real, but we don't know what it is yet. And of course, in science, that's a very exciting prospect. It could turn out eventually that it's some form of experimental flaw which no one has found yet. It's certainly a possibility. But it seems much more likely that because at this point there are no plausible alternatives suggested that that can account for these effects in the lab, that we're dealing with something which is like real and as yet unexplained non-local connections between people and between people in the environment. Hmm.
Let's go to another caller, to Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hello. I'm very glad that you're doing this program, because I have had psychic experiences. If they run in families, I don't know if they do or not, but apparently they do in ours because we seem to have several. I neither boast nor fear this thing. I'm just glad you're studying it. I've had experiences that really had to be psychic. They couldn't possibly be explained any other way. But I have to be rather quiet about it because you're quickly labeled a kook. So I have a hunch that probably it's one of those things that's in the closet, you know, it's underground.
Mm-hmm.
A really interesting thing happened one day. I was at a lecture on another topic. It was not about psychic phenomena, something else entirely. I don't remember what. But this topic of psychic things came up, and one person asked, I would like to see the hands of everybody in the room that has had a psychic experience. And nearly one-third of the hands in the room went up.
Mm-hmm.
I was amazed. So
that's the one-third that was willing to admit it in public.
I think you're right. So I'm awfully glad you're bringing this out of the closet. It is something we don't understand. And there are kooks and there are frauds.
Sure.
But you're doing the right thing by studying it. And I'm glad you mentioned family and kinship bonds, because ours tend to be within the family. You know, like I will have a foreboding that something has happened to my daughter, and sure enough it did.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really surprisingly close to what had happened. And then my son, I was never able to surprise him with a Christmas or a birthday present from the time he was 2.
Mm-hmm.
So I've really been flabbergasted at the way he could pick up a package that was wrapped oh so cleverly and tell me what was in it.
Mm-hmm.
He did that kind of thing again and again. It just really quite amazing.
Yeah. Well, the certainly from a historical basis, there is reason to believe that among family members there would be greater connections.
Mm-hmm.
And just recently, a doctoral dissertation at the University of Edinburgh was looking at the Scottish tradition of second sight, because that seems to run in families. And in particular, the person doing this study was interested in whether there were any genetic links that could be traced back through the heredity. And there is an inkling of not only the support of these ideas within a family, but possibly genetic links as well that might account for greater, what we might call, talent for these kinds of phenomena.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. It seems that, that people, some people will have stories to tell, like the caller, and that there is and has been over time a lot of this kind of anecdotal evidence, and that it then that prompted people to try to do some more disciplined sort of research to find out if you could take that anecdotal evidence and confirm that. I guess I'm still, you know, I certainly would place myself in the skeptic camp and would be inclined to ask that question. It's the old, why doesn't the flying saucer ever land on the White House lawn question?
Right.
You know, why is it that if indeed this does exist and there are people who have this sort of capacity, why don't we, you know, why doesn't someone do it on live national television? Or, you know, why isn't it that we haven't had a more dramatic sort of demonstration in a very public sort of way that would demonstrate to nobody's to everybody's satisfaction that at least this one person had these kind of abilities?
Well, one very simple answer to that is there's only one Michael Jordan. In other words, at the level of accuracy and repeatability that is the equivalent of the UFO landing on the White House lawn, there may only be a couple of people in the world that can do it at that level, and maybe they don't want to become a circus show. So, and there's another reason as well, which is that typically, from a scientific point of view, we're not that interested in the truly exceptional, but we're interested in what generalizes. Because after all, if there was only one person in the world making this claim, we could simply dismiss him as a nut. But because these kinds of claims keep popping up from throughout the general population over a long period of time, it sounds as though we're dealing with a generalized ability. Generalized abilities like creative insight or intuitive hunches, those sorts of things, tend to happen spontaneously. And so if you sat somebody down and say, be creative, or fall in love, or do something which we don't really understand yet, but we accept that it does happen, I think we're dealing with something like that in this case, that initially the effects seen in the lab are weak, the effects seen in the real world are spontaneous, and yet as we begin to get better understandings, both the hit rate in the laboratory and possibly even the effects that occur in the world because people are willing to talk about it, both of them will increase. So you could look at an analogy, say, with electricity. 200 years ago, all we saw were either weak, spontaneous, static electrical effects or the occasional blast of lightning. Most people would agree that, that these things didn't seem to be the same, and yet they're both electrical in nature and they weren't very well controlled. Well, it took an enormous amount of study over a long period of time to begin to understand the nature of what we were dealing with and to take these weak static effects and turn them into the trillion-watt power grids that we now have. And I suspect that the same will be true with this phenomenon as well.
Let's talk again with another caller. We'll go to line number three, and that is in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I don't claim any special psychic abilities and haven't had a lot of such phenomena beyond, you know, a few instances of friends having in different parts of the country having simultaneous dreams about me, things like that. But something I'm curious about, if there's been any research into any kind of correlation between what you're looking into and what Oriental medicine refers to as the energy body, and traditional Oriental medicine, there's really not a distinction made between matter and energy. That's sort of considered to be an illusion. And for instance, acupuncture deals with directly with the energy body trying to affect that, and even some ways more directly things like Qigong, which is you know, a conscious effort to control and move the energy flow within your body or within others, and even to work to affect medical changes, things like that. I just wonder if there's been any research in, you know, looking at those kinds of phenomena and, you know, trying to find any kind of relationship between what you're looking at.
Right. First of all, there's a cultural difference between the West and the East. From the Eastern point of view, the West is extremely skeptical about these things, and it's true. From a Western scientist's point of view, the reports that I've seen and videotapes that I've seen of experiments generally involving Qigong are not very well-designed experiments. On the other hand, the effects that they're reporting are gigantic, typically. Now, I do know of a couple of Western scientists who have studied Qigong, in particular looking at whether or not a Qigong master doing his thing could affect cell biology or biology of the cell itself. And one case reported a couple months ago at a conference was a Qigong master asked to affect brain tumor cells. These are these immortal cells that are used commonly in cell biology studies, to see whether or not he could slow down the growth of these brain tumor cells in vitro, just in dishes. And it was a very well-designed study where there were control petri dishes and experimental petri dishes and lots of different conditions to make sure that it wasn't being due to things like proximity of the Qigong master or thermal radiation from the hands and that sort of thing. And there were five experiments done, and basically they all showed the same trend, overall statistically significant trend, that something that the Qigong master was doing actually did cause the brain tumor cells to stop growing as quickly as the control cells. And so there are studies like that which take the ideas from the East, but the techniques from the West, which suggests that whatever they're doing is verifiable in the lab. So that's the primary link. I've also heard experiments where it's popular in both China and Japan to do something called ear reading, in which you paint a little kanji or katakana character on a piece of paper, roll it up into a ball, and then stick it in your ear. Well, of course, you don't do it for yourself. Somebody else prepares this little ball of paper and stick it in your ear, and then you use clairvoyance or something to read it. And the accuracy rates claimed for this ability is somewhere in the 90% range. And I've seen examples of the characters drawn and the impressions that the people get. And it basically is so much greater in terms of accuracy than anything we've ever seen in the West that I'm very suspicious about it. And so I'm not quite sure that I believe the results that are being reported. And yet, nevertheless, that's the kind of thing that is going on in Japan and China.
Well, it's all incredibly interesting, and it'd be, you know, fascinating to see how this develops over, you know, the next several decades.
Sure.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Thanks. To introduce our guest one more time, we're speaking with Dr. Dean Radin. He's director of the Consciousness Research Laboratory at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas and has conducted research into the era of parapsychology. He's written a book that's titled The Conscious Universe, The Scientific Truth of Psychic Phenomena, which looks at some of the kinds of things we've talked about. Plus, there's much more in the book, so if you're interested in taking a look at it, it's out there. It's published by Harper San Francisco. And we have a little bit less than 10 minutes. We'll try to get some more callers in the time that remain. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers, but if you try to call, you're going to get a busy signal because the lines are all full. We will go next to someone in Terre Haute, line number 4. Hello.
Dr. Radin, first of all, how do you spell your name so that I can look up your book?
It's spelled R-A-D-I-N.
Oh, that's the way I had it. I guess I would be, I must consider myself a skeptic as well. However, I have a very, very good friend who was born in Bombay, His family is Hindu. He and his siblings were educated in Catholic schools. He has two graduate degrees from here in the United States, so he's well-educated and a successful businessman. We went there last this summer, had a little bit of trouble getting a visa, and he had related to me that he had trouble getting a visa when he came here several years ago, but his grandfather intervened. His Hindu grandfather intervened, and the visa came quickly. When we first became acquainted, he would not stay in my office by himself, and I didn't know this was conscious for a while. And finally, I invited him to stay by himself, thinking that he thought that he shouldn't be there, you know, without me being there. And he said, "No, I can't stay because I'm afraid." And I said, "What? Of what?" And he said, "Do you believe in ghosts?" And I said, "Absolutely not, I don't." And he said, "Well, I do." And then he went ahead to tell me the powers that his grandfather had. And he went even to the extreme to say he had seen a bottle being levitated in the middle of the room by his grandfather. This may be, you know, a far field from your area, but I have never been able to find anyone that could comment on this, so I thought I'd try you.
Mm-hmm. Here again, we may be dealing with a cultural difference. In cultures like in India, certainly, the Far East, Brazil is another example. In cultures where these effects and much larger effects like levitation are well accepted, it is easy for people to see things that may or may not be real. This is not to cast doubt on your friend's experience, because the experience, of course, is real.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether or not it would be considered objectively real.
Mm-hmm.
The evidence for large scale, we call them macroscopic PK, macroscopic psychokinetic ability, like levitation or movement of large scale objects, spoon bending, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the Western world, in the laboratory, under controlled conditions, the evidence for such things is extremely poor. We almost never see any kind of large scale effect like that, that is convincing. This is not to say that it doesn't occur occasionally, because sometimes it does occur. It's just very, very difficult to repeat.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't get that degree of stability that convinces us that something is real.
Yeah.
So could it happen in principle, where there are occasionally exceptional events, possibly spontaneous, in which something happens that shouldn't happen? Well, I'm forced to admit, by the nature of the data, that yeah, these things are possible, at least in principle, even though we don't have any understanding about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
For no other reason than, for example, as I review in the book, there have been hundreds of studies looking at whether mind and matter interact. And the answer is very clearly yes, they do interact. And we're talking about interactions at the microscopic level, certainly nothing at the size of levitating a bottle. But nevertheless, there is an effect that's seen, and it's seen repeatedly. So if we take the skeptical Western culture with these very small effects that we see in the lab, and we put it into a highly supportive culture, well, perhaps that will increase the effect by a magnitude of 10 or 20, and larger effects can take place.
Mm-hmm. Well, he is certainly westernized. He's planning to bring his mother and brother here permanently, and he plans to stay here, but apparently culturally this is really embedded in him, and I have to support that he really believes it.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to read your book. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We'll see if we can do one more here. We'll go to Eureka, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'll ask two quick questions and get off the air. First of all, I wonder if you could just discuss this phenomena in terms of Western mind's fear of the irrational, and secondly, if you could comment on a man named James Randi, who is head of an organization, I believe, called the Society for the Investigation of the Paranormal. Thank you.
Right. The idea, I guess I'm not quite sure what the caller meant by the first question, the fear of the irrational? Or
perhaps it is that it's the kind of, because, you know, well, here I'm reading something into the caller's comments, but perhaps the reason that people feel uncomfortable about the whole thing is that it's because it is paranormal. I mean, mm-hmm. Because it's a little bit frightening. And when you really think about, you know, taking it to its logical conclusion, the idea that some individuals could influence others in this way, it is pretty scary. And
right.
Either that, or it could just be, and we're also kind of scared of mental illness as well, if we put it in that basket,
Sure.
And it gives us lots of reasons to be uneasy about it.
Yeah, but I think no more so than look at the history of science. And 200 years ago, everything was caused by capricious spirits. And with people who are scientists who have been courageous enough to buck the tide of conventional wisdom and actually investigated things like, why does the body become sick? And in lots of other natural events, which at one time were thought to be either irrational or supernatural, eventually we understand them as normal.
Hmm.
And by the way, paranormal simply means that there are effects that are reported in the real world which don't yet have a normal explanation, but are thought at some point will have a normal explanation.
Hmm. James Randi is probably well known among the community of debunkers, although I'm not sure that he really likes having that label applied to him.
Right.
I've talked with him a couple of times. One of his famous sort of things is that he says he has in his house he has a piece of paper on which is written a phrase, and it's sealed in an envelope in a drawer. And to any psychic who can tell him what's on that paper, all you got to do is tell me what's written there, and I will give you, I don't know how much it is now, $2,000 or $5,000. And he has been doing that, had that standing offer for many years, and he said so far no one's been able to do it.
Right. The current challenge is over $1 million.
Oh, it's that much now, huh?
10,000 from Randi and a million or so from other people have pledged for some kind of a psychic phenomena to be demonstrated. But there's something in the fine print which he doesn't often talk about, which is that whatever the effect is, it has to be demonstrated without any judging. In other words, it has to be self-evident.
Huh.
And what he's asking for is the UFO landing on the White House lawn. And so his money is safe, because we're not dealing with phenomena that are like that. It would be the equivalent, for example, of saying, okay, I really don't believe that Mickey Mantle can hit the baseball at all. And so we'll give him one chance. And even as one of the best in the world, we'll have a pitcher throw a ball, and if he can hit it, well, you get $1 million. Well, that's not a bad bet, because two out of three times, he's going to miss. He won't get a base hit. And if you take a normal person who probably can't hit the 100-mile-an-hour fastball at all, it's even a safer bet. So that kind of a challenge is basically what I call an entertainment challenge. There's very little chance of anyone being able to satisfy the idea of showing something which is self-evident.
I'm sorry to jump in on you, but we're simply going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Our guest, Dean Radin, and indeed his name is spelled R-A-D-I-N. If you'd like to look at his book, the title is The Conscious Universe, The Scientific Truth of Psychic Phenomena. It's published by Harper San Francisco.